From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Much of the focus of President Trump's state visit to Asia has been on China. Today on the show, our foreign policy contributor says he hopes for better working relationships with Japan and South Korea.
Two vital allies of the United States, two traditional, very hostile enemies, Korea and Japan, with a long, bitter history. And establishing better rapport with those two leaders, I think, is probably the most important outcome.
Then it's the future, or at least the future of nanotechnology.
You get a scratch in your car, light comes in, it pops open, and it repairs itself. I think these kind of things, these self-repairing materials, for instance, might come within 10, 20 years from now.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of Radio Chipstone and our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend comes your way next. News is first.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. President Trump's trip to Asia continues through the weekend. The president is addressing trade and economic links with world powerhouses such as China, even as Republicans back in the United States debate the tax cut measure working its way through the Senate.
Trump was in Asia as a handful of high-profile elections took place in the U.S. on Tuesday, elections that largely delivered victories to Democrats. That's where we begin our conversation with news analyst and foreign policy contributor Art Sear, who is with us in the studio. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for the warm welcome on a cold morning, Mitch.
We're talking shortly after the off-year elections took place, and I guess I want to start there in maybe a strange way, because as these elections took place, there are a number of gubernatorial elections, a handful of races for Congress as well, sort of special elections. The president of the United States was in Asia, and let me ask you your best sense for whether there was a purpose for having the president kind of far from the United States at a time elections were going on, or whether the timing was perhaps coincidental.
Well, to be honest, which is always the best approach, on or off the air, as an innocent academic, I actually hadn't thought about that till you mentioned it. Politicians often maneuver in one arena to try to distract attention from another, and foreign and domestic is a great way to do that historically. To actually answer the question, my guess is no, because this trip has been scheduled for quite a while. The Virginia race especially was considered close, and Ed Gillespie, the Republican who lost, at least until the voters spoke, was seen as having a chance to win. But that's a very good point, and a lot of people, including yours truly, have underestimated Donald Trump's political skill and success. I never thought he could do this in terms of getting the White House. So I'm going to think more about that, and I'm going to do a little research on it. Thank you very much.
Well, sure.
It's very plausible. Most skillful politicians often are those who are underestimated by people who think they're smart.
Well, and of course, in 2017, maybe it's foolish to imagine that the geographic location of someone has any influence on whether, you know, they're in the public consciousness, because, you know, in the times of Twitter and YouTube and everything, you know, a president can be wherever he wants to be at any moment.
Yeah, of course. But a presidential trip, even for a freewheeling operator like our current president, takes a lot of preparation. There are important events in Asia, quite apart from the nonstop hysteria emanating from and regarding North Korea and their nuclear threat, including the APEC, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Vietnam. And that takes some lengthy preparation. At the same time, it's been clear for some months that more than usual, an incumbent president, his party isn't challenged in off-year elections.
Well, let's talk about the Asia trip. What would be the ideal outcome for this country in President Trump's trip to Asia?
Better personal relationships between our president and leaders in other countries, and each of the countries of the five that he's visiting. That's true, especially, I would say, in the case of Japan and South Korea. More than China, two vital allies of the United States, two traditional, very hostile enemies, Korea and Japan, with a long, bitter history, especially in the 20th century. And establishing better rapport with those two leaders, Prime Minister Abe in Japan and President Moon in South Korea, both of them extremely skillful politicians and diplomats, I think is probably the most important outcome.
You talked about the idea of not underestimating Donald Trump.
Yes, obviously. Even I can understand that.
You know, what would you expect in this case? You know, are we underestimating Donald Trump's skill in forging these stronger relationships?
Perhaps. By important accounts, including from some of my students who were Donald Trump supporters in the last election and got to meet him at a rally in Milwaukee. The president has considerable interpersonal skill when he chooses to exercise it face-to-face. And I think that's we should very much hope for the best in that case. His often bombastic and threatening and off-the-wall, frankly, rhetoric tends to be toned down a lot of the time, not all the time, in personal meetings. The relationship with Japan is particularly important. He did not do so well in his first meeting with Chancellor Merkel of Germany. Both Germany and Japan have very moderate, very reassuring long-term leaders, and those relationships, for self-evident reasons, are particularly important. But his interpersonal skills can be considerable.
I want to talk about South Korea and North Korea for just a moment. And in just recent weeks, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin spoke to a group of high school students in the Milwaukee area. And one of the messages he talked with them about North Korea policy, which is interesting. And his take on it was that President Trump's unpredictability was an asset in dealing with North Korea. And on one level, speaking as an outside observer, that sounds ridiculous. And on another level, it raises a good question. In the case of a situation like North Korea, where you're dealing with a political leader who is, by many measures, unpredictable himself, is unpredictability an asset?
Yes. Very definitely, especially in high-stakes international relations. It reminds me of the private interplay that's now clearly in the public record and undeniably happened between President Nixon and Henry Kissinger, National Security Advisor and then Secretary of State, during the very tough, very, very difficult negotiations with North Vietnam and the National Liberation Front in Vietnam. Nixon said very explicitly, "Henry, I really want you to do your best to persuade them that I'm about to lose it and I'm about to use the big one," meaning nuclear weapons, in Vietnam. Franklin Roosevelt, a very great president in my view, was particularly inclined, to put it politely, to set people against each other, very consciously create competition among subordinates at home on domestic politics and policy, and in dealing with people overseas, including close allies. Winston Churchill in particular suffered. Roosevelt was very conscious about it as a way of maintaining authority. I also believe he had a very strong, cruel, and sadistic streak. I think he was a very great president, but it's also undeniable that he wasn't particularly nice in dealing with people. That's why Eleanor was so important and even more influential than he was with the American people, who are not stupid.
Well, so maybe let me ask you this. Are there different classes of unpredictability, sort of a public unpredictability and a private unpredictability?
I'm sure that's true. Yeah, and I think the Nixon-Kissinger example represents that. And let's all hope and indeed pray that when it comes to our current high-stakes international relations, that it's very much a calculated effort rather than the kind of spontaneity for which President Trump is quite rightly famous.
And maybe that's the distinction that we're talking about, the difference between unpredictability and spontaneity.
Yeah, I think that's thank you very much, Professor. I think that's very well put. You summed it up quite well.
Let me turn now to Russia, because since we last spoke in this studio, there have been the first indictments in the Russia meddling investigation, the Mueller investigation.
Yeah.
There have been from time to time comparisons to the Watergate era. Yeah. We were just talking about President Nixon a few minutes ago. And as someone who has studied that era and lived through it, can you walk us through how the current investigation both is and is not like the Watergate investigation as it played out in the early 70s?
There's no evidence of any criminal behavior that directly involves the president. Colluding with Russia, talking with Russians or anyone else is not in and of itself illegal, including regarding election matters in this country. I think the most important parallel, and I have thought a lot about this, as the person at the top sets the tone, whether you're in charge of a small operation or a big operation or a gigantic operation like the government of the United States. I think Nixon's fatal flaw was this terrible self-doubt and paranoia that plagued him, and in Shakespearean terms, no exaggeration, finally brought him down despite great achievements of a positive sort in the policy arena. I don't believe he was aware of the Watergate break-in, which was the initial crime that led to the collapse of his house of cards. He, however, associated with some very unsavory characters, and his personal faults communicated themselves with the organization. And I think that's the real danger in this case. But keep in mind that there's no evidence of criminal behavior. Manafort, in fact, I believe, one of the two men indicted, has associations that go back to the Nixon years. When I was in the U.S. Army many years ago, and for a while in charge of an Army platoon and then briefly a company, in a very difficult time for the U.S. Army in this country, domestically, it was a lesson that came home to me. You really can help yourself a lot in a difficult situation if you handle things the right way and generate trust. So that's the most important lesson. In terms of the specifics of this current debate, I'm not an admirer of Alan Dershowitz, a Harvard professor who's very controversial and has strong views and often gets carried away with his rhetoric. But the debate between him and others about the special prosecutor / special counsel, he really believes strongly that we're overdoing this in terms of immediately appointing someone who has a hunting license with tremendous power at the federal level, starting with Watergate. His complaint about this, and a lot of people criticize him, that's a debate well worth following, readily available in the press.
But you're saying you do not necessarily agree with Alan Dershowitz in this case.
I do agree with him in this case.
You
yeah,
okay.
I think, yeah, starting with Watergate, we've had special investigators at the federal level. A special prosecutor law was put in place in the wake of Watergate, and we had investigations of President Carter and Iran-Contra under Reagan, the first Bush administration, and, of course, famously Bill Clinton. That law ended, I believe, in 1999. But the momentum of this constantly seeking, often for very partisan reasons, to undercut a president continues. And I think it's very bad. I have looked into the history somewhat. It dates at least from the Grant administration, when a president who was undercut by corruption, a personally very honest leader. The Whiskey Ring investigation led to a special counsel appointed.
What are the alternatives?
The Truman administration, once or twice in between, but we have not historically. We've been more sensible, and it's become kind of a regular routine thing in the poisonous atmosphere of Washington today.
Right. So if not for special prosecutors, what are the alternatives to, legitimately finding corruption or illegal doing in the administration?
Yeah, breaking of the law in the executive branch at the highest levels. Dershowitz argues that a nonpartisan commission appointed by Congress is a much better approach and cites the 9/11 commission. There are others as a good example. I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a constitutional expert, and it's something I'm working to learn more about, but I think it's a debate that we all should be following. And it's basically a hunting license with the tremendous power of federal law enforcement behind you. We should use it sparingly.
Art Sear, fortunately, we use you regularly.
Well.
less sparingly.
I wish I spoke more sparingly sometimes.
But thank you so much, and I think this is a conversation we should continue having.
Absolutely. It's not going to go away, believe me, especially with the indictments that have come down.
Lake Effect foreign policy contributor Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business. He directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha.
Up next, we'll learn about some very, very, very small machines. We'll have a conversation about the future of nanotechnology when Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Dr. Ben Feringa is a professor of chemistry at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. He is also the 2016 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry for his work on very, very small things, especially nano-sized motors. Those devices could fundamentally change how we interact with our world. Imagine self-repairing materials or medicines targeted to specific cells.
Dr. Feringa was here last month to give the Nobel lecture at UW-Milwaukee, and he joined us in the studio then to talk more about his work. Dr. Feringa, it is such a pleasure to have you in the studio today. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
If you and I sat next to each other on a plane and I asked you what you did, what would you tell me?
Okay, I am a chemist and I teach at the university, so I'm a professor of chemistry. And so we teach the basics of chemistry, but with our students, of course, we also do research and try to design new molecules, new materials, think about the new chemical processes for the future, how we make fuels, how we make plastics, how we make pharmaceuticals. This is the kind of things we do in the laboratory. And in particularly, we like to look at the future, eh? What we cannot do today, but what we will be able to do tomorrow. How to make, for instance, sustainable chemical processes that cost low energy, eh? Need to make in a better way, make the materials for the future that we use in our daily lives.
So what kind of chemical processes are you trying to make better?
For instance, we make processes for a chemical industry, as I mentioned before. For instance, how to make a pharmaceutical. That usually takes a lot of chemical steps, a lot of processes. And we try to develop processes that need less material, that do it at lower temperatures, less energy, yeah, and in a much better way. So faster, cleaner. That's the way we try to do that. We often work also together with industry in this respect.
One of the things that you specialize in is the nanotechnology, the very, very, very small, building those
Absolutely.
tiny things that help all of those processes happen.
Yes.
And so I think most of us, when we think of nanotechnology, we think of Star Trek.
Right.
Or we think
right.
of science fiction. This is actually happening.
Yes, it's a bit of science fiction. First of all, nano is 1,000 times smaller than micro that you use in microtechnology. So nano is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, really tiny, the level of molecules, like the molecules in your body. And so we design these nano systems, and in particular what we try to do is to build molecular motors. So we built the world's first rotary motor the size of 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, 1 nanometer in size. Now think about motors, machines in your factories, in your cars, your planes, they are everywhere to the macro scale, the world around us. In your body, it's full of motors and machines that make it possible that we can lift our arm, that we can see each other, that we can talk, that things go in and out of the cells in our body. But we as chemists, so far, we're not very good in making things move. And now, for the first time, we can make these tiny motors and tiny machines at the scale of molecules, nanometer size. So this will be the nanotechnology of the future.
So is the idea that you can use these tiny rotary motors to, say, deliver a drug in a way that we can't now?
Yeah, for instance, it's a bit of science fiction. You mentioned it already. But indeed, when we look at this Asimov story, tiny robots, submarines that go in your blood veins and deliver a drug, a pharmaceutical, or detect a tumor cell, for instance, or do a repair in your body. I think this is still with science fiction. But once you know how to make a motor, how to make things moving at the nanoscale, you can imagine that in 40, 50 years from now, the surgeons, the doctors will inject these tiny robots in your blood vein, and they will go to deliver the drug, or to search for a defect cell, or do a repair. But there are many other applications. Think about when you cut your finger, yeah, it repairs itself. Now, if you have a scratch in your car, you usually go to the garage and then they have to polish it again, etc. But in the future, you can imagine you use these tiny machines. You get a scratch in your car, light comes in, it opens, it pops open, and it repairs itself. I think these kind of things, these self-repairing materials, for instance, might come within 10, 20 years from now.
That soon?
I think so.
Yeah, because that seems very much the province of science fiction for us, I think.
It is. But smart materials, responsive materials, you know, that will come. And biomedical applications. At the moment, we work, for instance, and I was discussing this at the university yesterday, we think about making smart pharmaceuticals, smart drugs. So imagine you take a pill. It's in principle, it's active everywhere in the body, but you hope it goes for where there is something wrong, an infection or so. But what we try to do is to make pills that you can switch on and off with light. So it's normally off. It doesn't be harmful to other parts of the body. You put a lamp on a specific spot and say you have somewhere an infection. You switch on the lamp. You switch on the drug, the pharmaceutical, and it does its job precisely there where it is needed and not anywhere else. That's a bit of a dream scenario. We have done the first test in the laboratories with cells. We try now to go to the next step, and hopefully we get to the clinic in the future.
And how long do you think it will be before that reality happens, where we can go to the doctor and say, you know, my heart needs something, we'll do targeted?
It is, of course, a bit of a dream scenario, and you know it takes a long time. A new pharmaceutical, it usually takes 10, 12 years and a lot of money to develop it because you have to go through all these clinical tests, etc. We are at a very early stage. This is very fundamental research, trying to do things in a very different way. That might take another 20 years before we reach that stage because there are many hurdles to take, and that's what we work on.
Not the least money.
And, of course, you need money. I mean, fundamental science, working with a team of scientists, students, graduate students, postdocs, to work on these kind of problems, it's very demanding. It needs lots of different expertises. We try to bring together, build these teams, also to work together maybe with companies and so, to see how we can develop this further. But it needs, indeed, money, because otherwise, if we don't have grants, if we don't have the facilities to do this, because it's complicated research, and it takes, indeed, several years to get to the stage where it can be applied. That needs a solid funding basis, and that is really important to bring us forward to the future.
One of the other things I think it needs is an understanding from the general populace that this kind of scientific research, A, is important, and B, as you say, takes time. It's not instant gratification.
No, let me take an example. Your iPhone, your smartphone. You cannot imagine, at least my children cannot, who are students, cannot imagine that there was a world without smartphones. Now, these were introduced 10 years ago or so. It has completely changed our world, the way we communicate, etc. The components for these smartphones were discovered by chemists and physics based on fundamental research, the transistors, the display materials for your screens, in the 40s and 50s of the past century. It took 50 years to bring it to the stage that we can build a smartphone, an iPhone. Now it's common, but it might take time from the fundamental discoveries in the laboratories, at the universities, at the research institutes, to bring it to the applications for our daily life. And it will change life, as we have seen with our smartphones. We cannot deny that. It completely changed our lives.
And so what do you think needs to be done to encourage people, maybe not to become chemists like you, but to support that kind of research?
Yeah, I think it is really important that in society we understand how important it is we educate our young people, because they will shape our society in 20, 30 years from now. That's prime importance. Invest in your youth, the education. And second, of course, invest then in science and development. Because it's not only the science, it's also the trajectory afterwards. You know, spin-off companies like you see here at the University of, in Milwaukee, the University of Wisconsin, where you have small spin-off companies, and they will bring it forward. New industries that will come with these solutions. Yeah, like, for instance, smart drugs, new materials that repair themselves, better processes for the industry that cost less energy, less materials, and are more sustainable. And I think these kind of investments will pay off because they will shape how we will have our society in the future. What kind of materials do we have? How are we going to drive in our cars? Do we have better batteries so that we drive electric cars and make it more sustainable? This is, I think, really important that we invest now in our future.
You won the Nobel Prize in chemistry last year. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
In addition to the prize itself and the honor that that confers on you and your research, what does that do going forward? Do you take that honor and say, okay, look, we're doing something really important, you know, gather investment for this?
Yeah, of course, we try to pursue our science and research on these tiny motors and machines and this nanotechnology in general. This is now spreading out. There is a lot of development ongoing in the research institutes around the world. And so I'm strongly advocating that. And I'm also doing research myself, of course, with my team. But what is also very important is that I go out and try to convince the politicians, the public, the schools, the kids, the teachers, how important it is to invest, you know, in education and science. So I take time not only to teach at the university and to do research, but also I go to elementary schools, I go to high schools, I give presentations for teachers and for students to emphasize the importance of education, of research, to think beyond our current borders and to make a better world. I see that as an important duty to bring the message forward, why this is so important for our future. And it gives also a lot of pleasure, I must say. If this award, this Nobel Prize, helps a little bit to bring this message forward to politicians, to the general public, to the school kids and the teachers, I think that's part of I see it as part of my duty, you know, to give something back to society.
You are a very happy ambassador.
Thank you so much.
Well, Dr. Feringa, I am so glad we were able to get you in the studio in your brief time here in Milwaukee. Best of luck with all of the research and all of your ambassador duties. It has been such a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Dr. Ben Feringa is a professor of chemistry at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. He shared the 2016 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his work on nano-sized motors. He was in Milwaukee last month to give the Nobel lecture at UW-Milwaukee.
We'll take a short break and then return with the next episode in our Radio Chipstone series. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. 2017 marks the centennial of Wisconsin's state capitol. But rather than focusing on the building itself, Madison artists Brenda Baker and Bird Ross chose instead to focus on a statue that's been greeting and encouraging the women of Madison since late 1895. Funded by women across the state, the statue, called Forward, was sculpted by Jean Pond Minor and holds court at the Capitol's east entrance.
For Ross and Baker, Forward is the inspiration for Being Forward, a photographic installation at the Playhouse Gallery in Madison's Overture Center. The work features over 100 photographs of Wisconsin women artists and supporters, and it includes Radio Chipstone contributor Jennifer Fields. The goal of the exhibition is to recognize the contributions of women to the arts and to create the Women Artists Forward Fund to support the work of female artists here in the state.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Jennifer Fields chats with Brenda Baker and Bird Ross about the project. According to Ross, the inspiration behind the work is multifaceted.
Certainly it comes from more places than I could, you know, really articulate at this moment. I mean, she's really been a real symbol, I think, especially if you think back to January of 2017 during the women's movement. There she was on the Capitol along with everyone else. And so it was obvious to us at that point that she really did carry a lot of energy and a lot of power and a lot of truth for a lot of women. So that was part of it. But also, she was made by a young 28-year-old woman in 1893. And this woman was one of two women chosen to be an artist in residence at the World's Fair. and to be in the Wisconsin Pavilion and to do her work there. And so, it, you know, she really garnered herself a very prominent position in world history by being able to be a woman artist, Jean Ponminer, at this fair in 1893.
And I think that one of the things that happens, Brenda, when we have public sculptures, when we live amongst these things, we forget who they are and we forget their power.
Right.
Am I reaching when I say that that's kind of the condition of the woman artist?
I definitely think there's an invisibility. I mean, if you look at the statistics, many of them that we've gathered from the National Museum for Women's Art in Washington, D.C., there's a lot of statistics that support that. I think 65% of the MFA graduates right now from the universities are women. We know that 3 to 5% of the collections in major galleries around the world are only 3 to 5% are artworks made by women. We know that in terms of positions, jobs in the arts, women make less than men. You know, there are lots and lots of statistics like this that sort of support the fact that women are less seen and less visible.
Bird, when you think about this and when you look at this project, one of the things that strikes me is that, I'm to be honest with you, there are women up there who are my friends that I know are artists, but I don't think about them being artists until I'm at one of their shows. For me, in my head, it's not part of their identity, and I'm wondering if that's part of the problem.
I think sometimes people are, maybe, I can't speak for all women, but it's tricky to identify yourself as an artist and as a female because, I don't know, because of the fact that maybe you're not necessarily taken seriously, or they want to know more about what sort of integrity do you have in your artwork. What is it about you being an artist that makes you someone that I should pay attention to? I mean, I feel like I'm sort of constantly grappling with the way that I should describe myself in a way that people get it, that it makes them curious, and it makes them realize that it's, even though I have a good time doing it, it's a serious business for me.
When I look at this wall and I see these women and I see us all in this pose and you see the objects that they're holding, when you see their tools, there's a woman holding a film camera, there's a woman holding brushes, there's a woman holding a work of art, there's a woman holding a hammer, there's a woman holding a frame, some are holding books, there's a camera lens. It really is this community.
Well, certainly I would say the process of doing this piece for both of us has been really eye-opening, and it's been a great community-building process. We've met so many people that we didn't know in the arts community, and I personally felt like I was very well connected in the arts community, but in fact I've realized there are so many people that I don't know whose work I'm not familiar with. So it was really eye-opening in that way, pulling this together, and I do feel like we've created a greater sense of community, at least for ourselves and those who have participated.
So, Bird, when this comes from an idea, when this comes from a statue that we've lived amongst, we've walked by her numerous times, was there a transformative moment when you saw these photos?
Well, what was I think the beauty of these images, now that they're up and on the wall, is the fact that there is so much variety, diversity that you alluded to before, and how they all are a part of the piece. They are all different, and yet they are all one in a way. And I think it's really fabulous to see a group of women up there who are supposedly dressed as the same, all as the same statue, and yet they bring all of their individual attitude, size, style, background, heritage, work, right into the piece. So we feel lucky that way.
Material culture contributor Jonifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. That project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
One more break now, and then it's time for our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
Two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal stories.
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it's time again for Ex-Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend here on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Rachel Owens, and joining us again is Ex-Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney. Hello.
Hello, hello. How are we?
Doing pretty well. Staying warm, wearing a lot of sweaters these days.
Yeah. Milwaukee, I'm telling you, within a matter of like 20 seconds, all of a sudden the temperature dropped 20 degrees. So...
Definitely. Well, it is November, so I guess we have to face up to that fact. And
yes,
that means that there are some more events coming up from Ex-Fabula we want to hear about.
Yes, yes. Today's theme is Risking It. And the reason why is that we have an event coming up on November 17th in collaboration with the South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center. A special Risking It storytelling event is going to be featuring Ex-Fabula curated tellers plus selected members of the community sharing their own true personal stories. So, and afterwards, the community and student storytelling workshops will proceed. So that'll be really, really fantastic. And a little quick note about, sometimes you hear the Ex-Fabula storytellers either like on the radio or you've seen them on stage a couple of times at our story slams or events. These particular stories from curated storytellers are going to be completely new Risking It stories. So I would definitely recommend getting your tickets for this particular event. And I do believe this is our first foray into the adventures at South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center. So,
all right. It's a very nice facility there, too, I have to say.
Yeah, that's what I hear. So, yes, that. And then we have a couple of other things coming up. But Risking It is the theme today. And I did bring a couple Risking It stories. So if we care to jump right in. Our first story is from Jen Heppner from our actual Risking It themed show in September 2016. Let's listen to Jen's story.
I went to school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, big party school, right? And as a lot of college students, I was pretty poor during my college days. And I remember one summer, I lived in a really tiny apartment with three other girls. We shared a bedroom, and it was hot. It was hotter than hell. There was like only windows on one side of the apartment, no air conditioning, just a couple of fans. And so we didn't spend a lot of time there. I spent most of my time during that summer working. I had two jobs, and I took a couple classes, and then I would party in the evenings. One really hot, steaming night, I was at a party, and I encountered a young man who was quite attractive. We were, you know, feeling each other and getting in the groove, and we went for a walk, and we started making out. And then I remember thinking, oh, you know, I want to get with this guy, but I don't really want to go back to my apartment because it's hot, it's cramped, there's these other ladies there, and we all share a bedroom. And he was like, well, I'm from out of town, and I'm here with a whole bunch of other people in, you know, a small apartment too. So we were at the Union Terrace, which is outside on Lake Mendota, a nice pier out there. It was like 4 a.m. and so there's nobody around. So we started getting busy on the pier, and it was great. It was awesome. It was like, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, we're doing something you're not supposed to do. Plus it was just having sex, and it was great. And in the middle of it all, I hear this and I'm like, I look over, I'm laying on the ground, and there's this boot right there by my face. And I look up, and it's a police officer. And I was like, oh. And the guy didn't notice. He was still going. And I'm like, tap, 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 tap on his shoulder. And he looks at me like, what? And I'm like, and he looks up at the police officer, and oh, man, what a buzzkill. Anyway, so he told us that we needed to stop doing what we were doing and get dressed. And then he was using words like public indecency and illegal things, and we were breaking the law. And as we are getting dressed, he gets out this big pad of paper. And it's like, you know, to make, write us a ticket. And I was like, oh, man. So he started with the guy first, asking his name and address and contact information. And then he came to me, and I was like, mm-mm, mm-mm. So my name's Jennifer Heppner, okay? And I lived in Madison at the time. But when he said, "What's your name, ma'am?" I was like, "Kelly Chmielewski." "Can you spell that, please?" "Chmielewski." "And where do you live?" 1109 Daisy Lane, Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. "Oconomowoc, can you spell that, please?" "Oconomowoc." And he believed me because I could spell all that stuff just like that without even hesitating. I got away with it. Now, I'm not Kelly Chmielewski, but she was my pen pal when I was like in fifth, sixth, and seventh grade. And so I had written her name and her address multiple times on envelopes. Well, she was my pen pal, and she's actually my step cousin, because her grandma married my grandpa when they were like in their 60s. And this worked so well that I used it a couple more times because I got caught for underage drinking and stuff too. And I would just make sure I never had any ID on me. I'm just like, "Chmielewski." "Yes, sir, officer. Oconomowoc. I look back on that now and I feel kind of guilty because Kelly is a real person and that was her real address. And I'm like, ooh, did she have to go to court and contest some things? Like, I was in Montana at the time. I wasn't on the pier in Madison having sex. So I feel like maybe I should reach out to her and just see how that all went down. But at any rate, sometimes when you risk it, you might need to have a good alias.
And that was Jen Heppner's very saucy little tale that she told at our Risking It Storytelling Slam in 2016.
I wonder if she ever reconnected with the real Kelly and to see how many outstanding tickets or court appearances she had to make on her behalf.
I know. We should probably like ask her to come in to do a follow-up on the story sometime.
It'd be more like one of those radio call-in shows where you get the person on the line, you've been ghosted.
Yeah. So yes, risking it is the theme today. I actually have a little personal story about risking it. Me and my new relationship, my boyfriend and I, are going down to South Africa on my first international trip and as well as our first international trip together. So that's very exciting. And
absolutely.
Hopefully we'll both come back in one piece.
We want to hear some stories about that.
Yes. Yeah, I'll chew your ear off about those when maybe on and off air, actually. So the next event that we have coming up is, of course, on November 17th. For our Risking It Storytelling event that's going to be held at the South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center. But we also have an Equal Access Story Circle on November 14th, which is free for individuals with disabilities as part of our Equal Access Project this year, which is an ongoing project that we have going on. And this event is going to allow you to practice sharing your true personal stories in a social environment and get feedback from other attendees. It's kind of like a story slam, but smaller, non-competitive, and less formal. And plus, we'll have people sign up to tell stories rather than pull names out of the hat. So you can come tell a story or just come to listen, but please pre-register to guarantee your seat.
That sounds like a good way for people who are maybe a little shy, but they want to start telling a story, maybe a good soft way to jump into it.
Most definitely. And this Equal Access Story Circle is just a really fantastic way for everybody in the community, people with disabilities and such, and not just physical, but mental disabilities as well, to come in and share their stories in a comfortable environment. So we're really excited about this project for sure. Let's get back to the theme of the day, which is risking it. Our second story was told by Tommy Vandergriff. So let's listen to her risking it moment.
My name's Tommy. I first came into service learning in 2009 as a UWM student, and I worked with the River Revitalization Foundation, and I actually still volunteer with them today. So it was a great experience for me, and when I started at the International Institute of Wisconsin, where I work now, I heard we worked with service learners, and I knew I wanted to do that. So I asked for that project. At the International Institute, we resettle refugees. So when they get into Milwaukee, we get them housing, get them settled in the city. The service learners do the stuff we can't do as caseworkers. So they go into their homes. They're their mentors for 3 or 4 months. They help them around Milwaukee, help them with homework, and that's kind of their role. So when I started, I was told, don't place any mentors with special needs families. And I was like, okay, because they seem like they need the most help, so I was confused. And they said students wouldn't understand at that age how to help them or how to work with them. So I didn't, for probably a year, place anybody with any special needs families of any kind. And then we got this family in from Burma, and it was a single mom with 5 kids, and then she brought her brother-in-law along with her, and she didn't have to. Her husband had died, but he was blind. And they really, really wanted mentors. And we really wanted to give them mentors because they had kids from, I think, 5 to 17 with this one mom who had to work and then her brother-in-law who couldn't work. So I thought, okay, I'm gonna give it a go. I placed them with some UWM mentors. And the first couple of weeks were shaky. I thought maybe I made a mistake. They were emailing me like, we don't know what to do. He can't see. Like, how do we teach him? And I was like, well, think outside the box. And like, I kind of gave them some ideas. And then the feedback sheets, I get them every week from every mentor. I'm supposed to. These two are pretty good about sending them. I could see the change. They are figuring out ways to teach him English without seeing, which was great. They found ways to include him in activities and get him out of the house. Isolation is a huge problem for refugees. And I heard around Thanksgiving, they had Thanksgiving dinner together. They helped him decorate a tree for Christmas. And at the end, I don't know how he made them because he's blind, but he made them these really pretty Karen bags that all the Karen families have if you're ever on the north side and you see them walking around. And now, because it was such a great thing, and then we gave them more mentors because they enjoyed it a lot. I make sure I place high needs families with mentors. So single moms, special needs, if it's mentally challenged or physically challenged, they all get mentors now because of these two mentors that tried really hard. So that's kind of my story.
And that was Tommy Vandergriff's story. She told at a UWM Service Learning Story Slam in May 2017.
Sounds like she really went above and beyond the call of duty.
Most definitely. Hats off to you, Tommy.
Absolutely.
So can recap just a couple of the events. We have our November 14th Equal Access Story Circle happening. November 17th is a special Risking It storytelling event with curated tellers as well as community members telling their stories, which will be fantastic. Also, you know, other things you can get online aside from information and tickets is our membership. And, you know, the holidays are creeping up on us. You know, you might want to start thinking about giving them the gift, because that gift that you give to somebody else, that X-Fabula membership, is a huge gift to us. And then the gift comes back to you guys again. It's this very awesome thing that just, you know, it's a give and take.
It's never too early to think about giving gifts. And, oh man, the holiday season, it always creeps up on me very quickly.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you for the gift of these stories today. And we want to wish you excellent adventures.
Thank you.
And also really looking forward to hearing your stories when you come back.
Definitely. All right. Well, I will see you in December.
All right. Happy travels.
Thanks.
X-Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show for today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening, because All Things Considered comes your way next. It's 4 o'clock.